In 1685, Azariah Pinney, the Lord of Bettiscombe Manor, was banished to the West Indies for his allegiance to the Duke of Monmouth. A man of acute business sense, Pinney made good his exile and prospered in the godforsaken colony, accruing a vast fortune which was turned over to his heirs on his death. Two generations were to pass before any of Azariah's kin dared set foot on English soil. It was his grandson, John Frederick, who returned to England in 1734 to reclaim the family seat in Dorset, bearing considerable riches and a negro servant from the Isles. However, shortly after their arrival in the country, Frederick's manservant, Isaac, was stricken with a malady that racked his body for days and only eased when the wretched fellow approached death. It was on his deathbed that old Isaac, who had served the family well, pleaded with his master that he must be taken back to his homeland for burial. If not, a terrible curse would befall the manor and all who lived therein. A phlegmatic man, John Frederick was not given to superstition, and duly ignored his slave's dying wish, discreetly burying his body in the local churchyard. It was then that the howling came. At first, many thought it a prank played by schoolchildren defying one another to remain in the churchyard after dark. But when one of the youngsters returned home, ashen-faced and shaking with fear after hearing a strange groan emerge from one of the graves, the games stopped and few would enter the graveyard again. And the wailing continued, louder than ever, a wild, keening sound that chilled the soul and which could be heard for miles around. The villagers knew the source of the shrieking. But Frederick would not heed their desperate pleas and refused to disinter the remains of his servant. And so the howling was joined by tremors and thunderclaps that shook the very foundations of Bettiscombe Manor. It seemed as if Isaac's corpse had risen from his defiled grave and was hammering angrily at the doors and shutters of his former household. If Isaac couldn't rest in peace, neither would his master. The din was appalling, but it had its desired effect, almost. Finally, 2 sleepless months after Isaac's burial, John Frederick wearily succumbed to the inevitable and exhumed the body of his servant. In such haste was the deed done that Isaac's rotting head was rudely detached from his body. Yet rather than return Isaac's complete remains to the West Indies, Frederick shipped his body back for burial, but kept the skull as a ghoulish memento of his recent travels. The skull was deposited in the loft, and the Lord of Bettiscombe Manor retired for an early night, comforted by the belief that he had done all in his power to appease Isaac's vengeful spirit. And a blissful silence descended upon the village once more. And so it stayed, until John Frederick's own death a decade later. However, the new occupant of the manor, William Thornton, had not been apprised of the skull's presence, and upon seeing its ghastly village, had it thrown into a pond behind the house. He instantly learned the error of his hasty actions, as an ear-splitting scream rent the air and drove him to the sanctuary of his manor. Quick were his neighbours to inform him of the nature of the cry, and the penalty for ignoring old Isaac's wishes. But Thornton was a proud man, and steadfastly rejected any attempts to retrieve the skull and let it defile his house again. No matter how much Isaac's ghost bellowed into the night sky or raged against the manor with his phantom fists, Thornton would not yield. Nor would he accept the accusation that Isaac's clamorous protestations were responsible for an unaccountable crop failure that year, or for the mysterious death of livestock in the region. It was to prove a fatal stand. On a bitterly cold January morning, The Lord of Bettiscombe Manor was found in a state of collapse by the edge of the pond, dressed only in a sodden nightshirt. Driven mad with fatigue, his spirit had finally broken, and he had stayed up the long night, raking the pond for the accursed skull, to no avail. He spent the rest of his short, tormented life on a sickbed in the wing furthest from the pond, but he could not shut out the damnable screeching. Within a year of taking possession of Bettiscombe Manor, William Thornton, a man of rugged health and fierce temperament, was dead, having faded to a shambling shadow of his former self. After his funeral, held many miles from Isaac's former resting place, a handful of villagers recovered the screaming skull from the pond, stole into Bettiscombe Manor under cover of dark, and restored the dread relic to the loft, and there it languished, content and quiet, for well over 100 years, as each of the manor's subsequent proprietors wisely paid greater heed to the legend of the screaming skull than their ill-fated predecessors. Most would never visit the loft, lest they encounter Isaac's spectre in a less charitable mood. But when Bettiscombe Manor passed into the hands of Charles Pomeroy in the early part of this century, events took a bizarre turn. The new owner, a modern gentleman of liberal disposition, promptly removed the skull, now encrusted in dust and a curiously sticky residue, had it polished, and reinstated the grisly heirloom to a more prominent position in the household. It was a well-meaning gesture and an effort on Pomeroy's part to return some measure of dignity to the memory of a former resident of the manor. He could not have imagined what followed. On the eve of the Great War, a torrent of blood issued from the cracks in Isaac's newly veneered skull, staining the mantelpiece on which it stood, and the blood would not cease. So shocked were visitors to the manor that Pomeroy was forced to return the weeping artifact to the loft. There it remained, reportedly oozing blood, when the outbreak of war was imminent.